You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
It is our absolute delight to have with us this morning celebrated poet, writer, translator, Martha Spracklin. You might think you know what you mean by the dark night of the soul. It's a phrase we use a lot in church. But maybe, just maybe you don't. And Martha's work has been to explore the works of St. John of the Cross, and we are delighted to welcome her here to tell us all about it and to share her work. Martha.
Hello, everybody. It's really lovely to be here at Greenbelt. I've been once before, about 10 years ago, I think. And I was just telling somebody on the way over here to the stage that when I came that time 10 years ago to read some poems, I'd only planned to stay for the day, so I hadn't booked anywhere to stay. You know, I had a train booked to go back in the afternoon. And I got so caught up in the amazing conversations and talks and music that I just missed my train quite happily and had to borrow the sleeping compartment of somebody's tent so that I could stay overnight and enjoy more of the festival. So it's lovely to be back here and to be talking about John of the Cross. So this is the book. It was published in May by Penguin Classics. And it's been a really exciting project to take on. It kind of fell into my lap. You know, I'd long known about John of the Cross, or thought I did. I knew about his Dark Night of the Soul. I knew a little bit about his biography. But there was a lot that I found in there that surprised me. The whole project, the whole translation took about 3 years, a real labor of love. I took it on just when I was pregnant with my son, and I thought, I can get this done in a year. And that was a mistake, so we had to push the deadline back twice. We published it, or I sent it off to the printer just as he was starting to talk, and then it was published this year, just before his third birthday. So you've heard a little bit about who I am. So I'm mostly an editor to the books trade, and I translate from Spanish. I'm also a poet. But John of the Cross, if you want a really good little potted biography of John of the Cross, you'll know a lot about him perhaps already, but Colin Thompson's introduction to this volume is really invaluable, sort of laying out the timeline of John's life and some of his influence on later writers and thinkers. John of the Cross was born in Avila in 1542. Avila is just in the middle of Spain, near Madrid. And he had, you know, an early life marked by some poverty and hardship. And he joined the Carmelite orders as a young man and soon fell in with Teresa of Avila. And together they founded new orders and sort of toured around together, bringing people to the cause. I think the thing about his biography that people know most about is the time that he spent imprisoned in Toledo, in a tiny, I'll talk about this a bit later, but in a tiny cell, a few feet by a few feet, in almost complete darkness for the best part of a year. The only light he had came through a tiny little hole in the wall of his cell, that went into the next cell through which some light would come at a certain time of day. And so it was just enough for him to stand on a chair and read his breviary. So we know a little bit about how these poems came about. It didn't seem that he was writing poetry really until this huge experience that changed him. He had very little access to writing materials. It does seem possible that some ink and paper were sort of snuck into him by a sympathetic jailer, but it seems partly from the structure of the poems and partly from evidence from people who knew him at the time that he composed the best part of some of his major works in that dark cell in his head, you know, using rhetorical structures and what we might now call memory palaces to begin the work on his spiritual canticle. And then he escaped in the summer. He climbed out of a window with these poems in his head and then went on to continue to found new orders and really dedicate his life to the Carmelites. He was in charge of the spiritual and pastoral life of the nuns in his care. And then he died in Úbeda at the age of 48 or 49. And he was canonized in the 18th century. So that's a very short little introduction to him. But as I say, have a look at Colin Thompson's introduction for a more sort of full explanation of his life. So I thought I'd start with some of the poetry. I've mentioned the spiritual canticle, and I'll read the first 10 or so stanzas of that. John of the Cross was very influenced by the Song of Songs, and in this extract, the soul personified as the bride searches for her beloved. Spiritual canticle. Where do you hide apart, beloved, and leave me here to moan? You leapt and bolted like a hart, left me wounded and alone. I came clamoring after, but you were gone. Shepherds, if you should chance to see as you roam the sunlit hillside between the sheepfolds, he who I most adore pass by, then tell him this: I suffer, sorrow, die. For my love, I'll go and look over mountains and along rivers. No flowers will I stoop to pick, nor fear any wild creatures, but boldly pass fortresses and frontiers. O wild wood, brake and bramble sown by the hand of my beloved. O meadow, green enameled and with flowers covered, tell me, came he through you as he fled? Spilling his thousand graces, he came through these groves in haste, and with the merest glance of his fair face turned toward them as he passed. In his own loveliness they were dressed. Ay, who can cure me of this ache? Give your true self up to me complete. Send me no more for my sake messengers who, though they speak, cannot hope to show me what I seek. All those who happen by this spot, broadcast your marvels numberless. Wound me with their prattling chat, those stammering, tattling stutterers. I die with each new utterance. How can you stand to live, O life, where your own life lives not? Love's arrows strike you near to death. Each straight and skillful shot pierces you with what he has wrought. Why, though you brought this heart to grief, will you not seek to make it whole? And why, having robbed me of it, thief, have you abandoned all that spoil, rather than possessing what you stole? Come and sate my bright desires. No one else can ease this plight. Come, show yourself to my eyes, for you alone are all their light, for you alone I grant them sight. O fountain of tumbling crystal, if only on your silvered surface you would suddenly reveal those longed-for eyes whose gaze is figured in my deepest places. Beloved, turn them aside, for now I take to the sky. So that's sort of the first, roughly the first third of the spiritual canticle. And you get a sense of, well, you know, what his work is really marked by, this profound passion that he felt, the intensity and richness of his language. But of course, you know, all of this presents certain difficulties for the translator. I'll read a little bit from my translator's note, which lays out some of those difficulties. The poems of John of the Cross are notoriously thorny to translate. Even in his original Spanish, he can be exasperating. In 1853, Francisco P. Imargal clearly felt the same attraction and impatience with which I encountered him. He is lax, he is incorrect, he is careless in his phrasing, he is monotonous in his frequent apostrophes, uneven in his timelines, not very harmonious in the combinations of his words. He has, in short, serious flaws. Like much mystical writing, there is a great deal that is mysterious or muddling. But for the mystic poet, the mystery of poetry, its ineffability is integral to the religious experience it describes. God, like poetry, like desire, is ineffable. And we must acknowledge the rightness in all this wrongness, the beauty of John of the Cross's peculiarity emerging from precisely those unharmonious combinations themselves.
There is, alongside all of this exuberant sprawl, a great condensing of language. And we find this, for example, on the verbs ver, which is to see, and esperar, which means both to wait and to hope. In the poem, I die because I do not die. The repetition here works to create a sort of paradoxical, many-layered nonsense with which John of the Cross conveys the mystical experience of the divine. I'll read it in the Spanish so you can hear. This is just a little stanza, just so you can hear the sound. Y si me gozo, Señor, con esperanza de verte, en ver que puedo perderte si me dobla mi dolor, viviendo en tanto pavor, esperando como espero, muérome porque no muero. In English, and if, my Lord, I should delight in hope that I may see you, on seeing that I may lose you, my agony is doubled twice. I live in this enduring dread, and in enduring hope abide, dying because I do not die. Part of the problem for the translator from any language into any language, is the question of form, particularly in poetry, obviously. And these poems are formal. You know, they have meter, they have rhythm, they have rhyme. And that rhyme is really something that's very hard to carry across into another language. You know, some people say that true translation doesn't exist because each language carries its own freight of sound sense and sound meaning that the consonants themselves carry onomatopoeic meaning through the language. So we have to accept from the outset that that we can't make a perfect translation. There have been a number of translations of John of the Cross, and I hope that people will keep translating it for each new sort of cohort, each new audience, to discover him in a language that meets them where they are. But it's not, you know, I think it would be difficult to try and replicate the form in English. And some have tried to do just that, or, you know, and it comes out very, very strange. You know, English, it's very hard to explain, but, you know, he uses the lira form, a kind of Italian hendecasyllable, to which English is completely unsuited. You know, our speaking fluidity, our speaking meter is totally different. So David Lewis had a version in 1909, which was very, very faithful, but, you know, not very beautiful. And he didn't attempt any rhyme in the English, which was perhaps sensible for his own mental well-being. Kathleen Jones, who published in 1993, spun those five-line stanzas that I've just been reading from the Spiritual Canticle into quite threadbare four-line stanzas, really, and lost a great deal of the poem's intensity and compression in so doing. One of my favourite previous translators of John of the Cross is Roy Campbell. His version came out in the 1950s, and he did take on the challenge of the metre. You know, he was a very good poet, and it was an impressive feat, though I don't think it was always fruitful, you know, in striving to match his breath to the line and his ear to the rhyme. He sometimes tied himself in real knots, so you end up with, but if aught please me, as I duly, in you yourself the cause construe. You know, it sort of works, but it's I don't think it opens the door onto John of the Cross's poetry for the English reader in a way that I have hoped to do. English is a stress-timed language. Spanish is a syllable-timed language. So the qualitative meter of iambic pentameter might be thought a sort of natural fit for English speech patterns, as I say, but it's not so for Spanish. And you could make the argument for just converting, you know, into iambic pentameter. Why not? You know, that would be one solution. You would be achieving the same kind of spoken fluidity that the Spanish reader hears. But, you know, I feel like that's a bit of an impersonation, really. There's something about the long, spilling line in his poetry that I wanted to preserve. And so, really, I haven't imposed any one sort of approach here. All the poems are different. There are 16 poems in this book, some longer than others. And they were all written at different times, under different conditions, and to subtly different ends. Some of them were meant more as teaching tools. Some of them were expressions of his passion. And so I think any sort of blanket approach would have been inappropriate. I should mention one of my favourite translation moments. I mean, when I speak to people about this, they look at me like I'm absolutely bananas, which is fair enough. But there's a particularly famously untranslatable line in the seventh stanza of the canticle, including that section that I just read. So I'll go back to it in a minute. And the original has a really beautiful... Not that. The original has a very beautiful onomatopoeia. Un no sé qué que quedan balbuciendo. Un no sé qué que quedan balbuciendo. And it means something like, and I don't know what, that they keep on stammering. So you've got the stammering in there. No sé qué que quedan. That que does not easily reproduce in English, you won't be surprised to hear. And every translator has approached it differently, all of those translators I've just mentioned. So Roy Campbell evaded it, and he wrote, babbling, I know not what strange rapture they recall. Frederick Nims employed the rather odd-sounding something, the telltale tongue, a stumble, said it. And Linda Nicholson used a dash to suggest hesitation or fragmentation. There are various other approaches. They keep babbling bits of mystery or ill-conveying the who-knows-what that baffles all they're saying. That one's not too bad. David Lewis, like many others, ignored the onomatopoeia completely, rendering it simply as, I know not what, of which they are darkly speaking. And I have, you know, I have to admit it, introduced words that don't literally appear in the original. These are the choices the translator has to make between fidelity and feeling, I suppose. And I tried so many versions of this, so many attempts at bringing that onomatopoeia through into English. And in the end, I had to go back to English and think, how do we stutter? You know, in Spanish it is k-k-k, and in English it's usually t-t-t. So actually that's the solution to the problem, I think. I'll read the stanza in question again. So I ended up alliterating on the T. All those who happen by this spot broadcast your marvels numberless, wound me with their prattling chat, those stammering, tattling stutterers, I die with each new utterance. So, you know, no solution is perfect, but I think the puzzle of it itself is so fun and so joyful. You know, all of this is to say I really enjoyed doing this, and I think... You know, I like to think that I'm sort of suited to this kind of obsessive work, being an editor as well as a poet. So I found this fun, you know, and I think that's part of what really surprised me about this work, about translating John of the Cross. At one point early in the work, I was on a train on the way to Manchester with all my notes and the original versions spread out on the table. And the fella opposite me, you know, peered over at what I was doing and then said, bloody hell, John of the Cross, heavy stuff. And he looked very sorry for me, actually. And it's true, you know, there's a lot of darkness. There's a lot of despair. There's a lot of grief and longing and difficulty. But there's great sort of passionate joy in there, too, in his feeling for God. And that comes through in the poetry. I'll read a second little bit of the spiritual canticle from slightly later to get a sense of the sort of joy of his descriptive language. This is the bride speaking about her spouse. My beloved, the mountain highlands and secluded wooded valleys ranged below, the strange and distant islands, rivers in their thunderous flow, the lovelorn winds all whistling low. Before the lifting of the dawn, the night in slumber lies subdued. The silent song, the sounding solitude, this supper, love awakened and renewed. Our flowering nuptial bed that dens of lions circle and surround is in richest purple clad, of steadfast peace raised from the ground and by a thousand golden shields is crowned. Following your foot's clear mark, swift maidens run reading the signs, drawn after your elusive spark, its savour of spiced wine, the sweetest balsam scented and divine. In my lover's deep-delved cellars I drank, and when I emerged dazed onto those wide acres, I had lost all thought, my herd scattered and lost across the sward. There he offered me his breast, there taught me one delicious lesson. And I gave him all that I possessed, keeping nothing back. In my passion as his bride, I pledged all my devotion. I now employ my spirit entire, all the gift within my soul. I tend and graze a flock no more, nor have any other given toil. This work of love is my only role. If I'm not found on the pastures, if I am neither glimpsed nor tracked, say only that I lost myself at last, wandering and love-struck, and then that I was found and gathered up. Sorry, it's all going on. So this volume here, as I say, there's only 16 extant poems. It's quite a small body of work, although a couple of those poems are run quite long. So this volume also contains a selection of his body of prose. It's a huge body of prose. Part of it is these commentaries, these long extended commentaries on the poems. You know, he really wants his reader to understand. When people accuse him of being obfuscatory or muddling, you know, I don't think it's true at all. He goes line by line, image by image, you know, drawing on all the sources he has to hand to explain what he means, and so that he can use them as a sort of teaching aid as well. So in here, we reproduce part of the commentary on Dark Night, one of his most famous poems. And it is dense, you know, but it's really fascinating and full of allusion and complex intertextuality that I think is really rewarding. I think it's really rewarding, you know. I hope other people do as well. But there's also a selection of spiritual maxims. He wrote hundreds of these small, sometimes only a few words, sometimes a paragraph, maxims. And some of them, you know, when we read them now, they don't feel as if they have anything really to do with his feeling for God, you know, his spiritual feelings. Some of them read almost like platitudes. You know, don't gossip about your neighbour, keep a nice and tidy house, that sort of thing. Keep a robust spirit is one I quite like. But his passion, I think, is always there. It's always simmering just below the surface. I'll just read a couple of those maxims as well as the poems. Some of them are almost like poetry themselves. Okay, number. They're all known by a number. 129. These are four little maxims on a page together. 129. Rise up above yourself. Seek rest in nothing at all. 130. Turn against yourself, hot-tempered and unceasing. 131. Abscond from company in your thoughts and bar the door to all. 132. Cleansed of all attachments, thoughts, and images, sigh forth your soft song with tears and sorrow. 106. 106 is my favourite, I think. Do not graze in this life's forbidden pastures, for blessed are they that hunger and thirst after justice, for they shall have their fill. God seeks to make of us gods by participation, he being himself God by nature. So fire turns all things to fire. I will read one more of these maxims because it teaches us a little bit more about the translation, I think, the difficulties of translation. This is another of those famous untranslatable bits. It reads, undazzle yourself, embracing submission and service to help you seek God. The light that shines on exterior things prevents us from stumbling. But in the interior matters of God, the opposite is true. If the soul is to walk securely, it's better that it cannot see. So I mentioned this in the translator's note as well, but I'll just lay out that word, undazzle. Undazzle yourself. So this is a, you know, very, very thorny moment for any translator. The word undazzle in the original is desanthillar, which is a word that only appears here and only appears once. So really it seems to be a sort of invention of John of the Cross's own. It's been variously translated as the submission of a servant, living without light, and freedom, among many other things. So it's a very polyvalent term that English translators have approached very differently. And some have suggested that it might be a transcription error, you know, that perhaps this should be desencandilar, which has connotations in the context of light. Or perhaps it should originally have been desatinar, to release, to let go. But as I've said elsewhere in this note and today, John of the Cross was very given to punning, you know, to lexical invention and the creation of new words and what I read as play, actually, joy in the language. And so I agree with Lucinio Ruano de Iglesia, and he says that desanciar might be a Latinism, di ansiari, which means not walking any longer in servitude. So the word here, as John of the Cross has it, this is very complicated, but again, this is my nerdy delight in this sort of thing. What he's managed to do there is to bring together two terms, that one of which has to do with light and one of which has to do with freedom from servitude, and he's brought them together in one invented word. So it's carrying all this meaning, which is particularly relevant in the context of his Dark Night of the Soul, which, as we were just chatting about this by the side of the stage, you know, it is often, I think, misunderstood what the Dark Night of the Soul actually is. You know, it is despair, but it's completely necessary. You know, this darkness is protective. This is the darkness that allows the soul to step out of the sleeping house of the senses and walk towards God. And, you know, John of the Cross is really, he holds a lot of these paradoxes, darkness and light, height and falling, the soul that is both bold and meek. Perhaps I'll read two of the shorter poems. It's nice to get more of a sense of the poetry, isn't it? Because I could rabbit on about the intricacies of translation all day long. I'll read The Pursuit of Love. For love I leapt up on my quest, on wings not lacking hope. So high I flew, so high, then stooped upon my waiting prey at last. I was the hawk in fast pursuit, and flew to snatch him from the sky, and urged my soul to soar so high I dwindled distant from my sight. I climbed the steep and winding air and soon began to faint and tire, but love drove me ever higher until I spied my quarry there. Higher into dizzying blue I went, eyes dazzled, blown adrift, and made my awesome conquest under veil of darkness true. But as this chase was all for love, I blindly sprang into the dark to trace my high and breathless arc, and saw and seized my prey above. The higher skies I summited in falcon love's sublime crusade, the lower and more grave my humble spirit plummeted. Who could reach it? I cried out, as my soul fell lower, lower. But still I flew high heaven over, until my quarry there I found. Strange that this one flight by dark should hold more than 1,000, for the dearest hope of heaven will never fail to hit its mark. The hope that set me on this quest sped true the arrow of my flight, so I could fly so high, to clasp and take my prey at last. And I'll read. I die because I do not die. I read a little snippet of that earlier. These poems, sorry, I should say something about the form. You'll see this on the page, but that previous poem I read began with a little four-line sort of epigraph. It's a sort of refrain that then doesn't fit the meter of the rest of the stanzas. So here there are three lines up at the top that sort of serve to introduce the poem. And these three lines here read, I live but not within myself. In hope I spend my only life. I die because I do not die. And that refrain comes back at the end of each stanza. I live within myself no more, and without God I cannot live. Bereft of self, deprived of him, what will all this life be for? 1,000 deaths will I endure and wait for my life to arrive and die because I do not die. This life I live and live again is naught but love's withholding, this perpetual death undying until I live with you in heaven. My Lord, hear me, listen.
I do not want to live this life and die because I do not die. In your absence and alone, what life can I hope to have but this suffering for death unlike the world has ever known? I pity me, a wretched one, still obligated to survive, to die because I do not die. The fish snatched from the water must have some alleviation in that death's annihilation brings the end of all death's torture. What death, though, could measure against this agony of mine? The more I live, the more I die. When I search for some relief and seek you in the bread and wine, it only causes deeper pain, for joy of you I cannot reach. Everything summons me to grief. I cannot touch you, though I try, and die because I do not die. And if, my Lord, I should delight in hope that I may see you, on seeing that I may lose you, my agony is doubled twice. I live in this enduring dread, and in enduring hope abide, dying because I do not die. From endless death now lift me out, my Lord, and give me life. Don't leave me struggling for breath, detained in fetters bound, for look, I need you here at hand to witness just how low I lie, dying because I do not die. I will mourn my death already and lament the life I live in, while the world of earthly sin still holds me in captivity. Ah, my God, when will it be? When at last may I say for sure I live and I will die no more? It is heavy stuff, isn't it? You know, I think he was right. What shall I read now? Oh, I'll read Dark Knight, I think. Perhaps go back briefly to, how much time do we have? Oh, loads. I'll go back to the translator's note and talk a little bit about the sort of reception of his work. You know, many, many writers over the years, writers, artists, musicians, thinkers, have been captivated by John of the Cross. You know, T.S. Eliot famously was obsessed by him. James Joyce, Lorca, Mary Oppen, Elizabeth Jennings, Charles Wright, Dorothy Day, many, you know, Geoffrey Hill particularly. So he's really set hearts ablaze for centuries now. And, you know, we might ask the question, what draws us to him? You know, why do we keep on reading him and keep on translating him? Why is he so important, not only as a thinker in the church, but as a poet? You know, what is it about his language that really draws us in? His poetry is obviously very sensual and very obsessive, and many have called it immoderate, which I think is probably fair, actually. It's not very moderate, is it? Arthur Symons observed in 1899, "This monk could give lessons to lovers." But Evelyn Underhill says, you know, it would be strange if he could not, you know, since their finite passions are but the feeble images of his infinite one, their beloved, the imperfect symbol of his first and only fair. So I think, you know, for any contemporary reader, we've got to be careful of applying our own context, our own understandings and our own mores to his passion, to the passion that he's describing here. Gregory the Great cautions us in reading John of the Cross. "Let us consider this book carefully, lest we linger over exterior meanings when we hear the words of exterior love. Otherwise, the very crane employed to lift us will instead burden us and thus not lift us. In these bodily words, in these exterior words, let us seek whatever is interior. And when we discuss the body, let us become as if separated from the body." All very well to say that. And for me, much of that distance proved impossible. How surprised I was, how confounded almost, to come up against John's extended metaphor of the loving God as nursing mother. The idea of, you know, spiritual milk, the sweetness of that gift has its tradition in such writings, of course. But I think what's quite radical is John's embodiment of these ideas in such intimate and corporeal language. The act made real by what he describes as the warmth of the breast and the practical necessity of the bitter aloe that would be daubed on the breast at the time of weaning. And then the shock and uncertainty of the child who is set down from its mother's arms, feeling a great strangeness, all that they have known now upended. And as I said, you know, this is a time when I had just become a mother, and I couldn't help but inhabit the physicality of this language, of these poems, as with one hand I marked up pages for redrafting, the other arm cradling my breastfeeding infant son. Patricia Lockwood wrote in the LRB, "When reading the accounts of the mystics, we are in their mind, sorry, in their ands, and their contradictions, and yes, their negations, but we are also in their bodies." And I feel that perhaps more accurately in reading John of the Cross, we're brought into the centre of our own. This isn't to deny the full spirituality, of course, with which John of the Cross composed these poems. He didn't write autobiographically. You know, what we know of him is from secondhand sources. He didn't write about his own childhood or his own feelings, really, outside this great single passion. So we hear almost nothing about his body or his day. You know, we've just got his lyric eye peering out from this blazing heart. He didn't complain of the privations and discomforts he suffered in captivity, although they were very great, or the privations of his mendicant life. He was a man of God in the truest sense, dedicated in extremis to his own relationship with his God, even over and above the Carmelite cause in whose service he worked as a great organiser. So as I've said, he composed the spiritual canticle and other poems in his head while imprisoned in Toledo, weaving together the Song of Solomon with various traditions of Spanish love poetry and popular song, as well as his religious sources. What he felt in his cramped, dark prison, we can perhaps extrapolate, we can guess at it, though the corpus that comes down to us hardly mentions it in his own hand. Given the paucity of autobiographical material and the relative scarcity of insight into his personal life, reading the poetry seems to open a strange high window in the wall of this reticent, self-contained man. I should read Dark Night. This is his best known poem, variously known by the title Dark Night or Dark Night of the Soul or Songs of the Soul. In the middle of a dark night, restless with bright love burning, oh, fortunate delight, I slipped out, no one seeing, now that all my house lay sleeping. In darkness and secure, I went by a secret stair, disguised, oh, lucky venture, in darkness and concealed, my house now being lulled to sleep. In that night of bliss and joy, seen by none, in secret and quiet, with no clear vision I stepped forth, with neither guide nor light save that which burned within my heart, and shone to light my journey more surely than the midday blaze, to where one who I know truly, beneath no overlooking gaze, awaiting me there stays. O shepherding night, O night lovelier than ruddy morning, O dark night that entwined the beloved with his darling, lover to beloved now transforming. Onto my flowering breast, tended and kept for him alone, he sank down into his rest. I gave him everything I owned, and sweet air from the fanning cedars flowed. The breeze over the parapet blew and moved his hair under my hand, and with his own calm touch he drew across my throat another wound, and all my senses were subdued. There I stayed, and there forgot, my cheek laid on my beloved fair, and all things ceased, and I was lost, and all my worldly doubt and care were sunk among the lilies there. I think I'll just end by reading, I mean, it might be nice to have time for a couple of questions if anyone wants to ask them, although please go gently with me. You know, I'm here as a translator, so I might not be as well informed as many of you on the more complex matters of theology. So but I'd love to answer any questions you might have about the process. And I'm doing a, I promised I would mention I'm doing a signing at 12:45 over in the books tent, and happy to chat more then as well. So I'll just end with a little bit from the end of the spiritual canticle that I've read two sections of already. My beloved, let's rejoice and be happy, and hear in us your sublime echo. In the mountain and all its hidden valleys, its singing streams and melted, rushing snow, and hand in hand into the thicket go. Then we'll clamber to the heights, the caves with walls of cooling stone, to places hid from common sight, and together we will enter in and savour the young pomegranate wine. There you will show to me what my soul has sought and craved, and later still give to me yourself, love of my life, the same as you revealed to me the other day. The velvet air soft breathing, the nightingale's effervescent song, the thicket spell in weaving the serene night dark and long, a supple flame that burns yet does no harm. And now we were watched by none, not Aminadab in his devilish disorder. The siege was done, and now the cavalry would wander down again at sight of the waters. I'll end there, I think. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I was wondering if you could just say a little bit about your own journey being immersed in that work and how that might have affected your own spiritual life. Mm.
Thank you. That's a really interesting question. My own spiritual life is quite borderless and complicated. Everyone's is, I'm sure. But, you know, I came to this as a translator and as a poet, rather than, the drive to do this was for the poetry. My spirituality doesn't necessarily operate in the same sphere as John of the Cross's. But it has certainly changed my inner life. It's certainly changed the way I feel about devotion and prayer and passion and solitude. I think one of the most revealing things for me, you know, as I said, as I undertook this work, this 3 years was a period of really profound change in my own personal circumstances around the birth of my son. And I think a lot of what spoke to me in John of the Cross's poetry was the idea of this necessary renunciation. You know, people read his exhortations to shut yourself off from the world as something quite negative, you know, that we've been given this gift and he's suggesting that we ignore it or don't take pleasure in it. And that's not how I read it at all. But at that time of great change in my life, I heard real truth in the need to move beyond certain things that might be holding us back in terms of our personal, spiritual, devotional development. And that was really instructive and really affecting, actually, and quite emotional for me. And, you know, on a very practical level, reading him and delving into the Bible again, which I hadn't read since I was a teenager properly, you know, as one work, delving back into those pages has been a revelation for me as well, and I've been reading around the mystics more generally, and I think I've been changed by that. So I've got a new collection of poems coming out next year, and I thought I knew what that was going to be about. You know, I was writing about microbial life and motherhood, and of course it's just transformed completely, and now a lot of the poems in that book are about this experience of translating John of the Cross, taking some of his teachings and some of his lines even from his poems. They've become completely intertwined with my own feelings about some of these subjects as we go through. And in fact, the title of the collection is going to be Question to the Creatures, which is a line from the Spiritual Canticle. So this has been a real fulcrum, I think, for me. In every way, really.
I think you've partly answered what I wanted to ask about, but maybe you can reflect a little bit more. Comment, first of all, someone who's read poetry my entire life, I've always thought that the work of translating poetry is one of the hardest creative intellectual endeavours anyone can undertake, and I think it's often hardly noticed, so thank you for that work.
Thank you.
But I wanted to ask you to reflect a little bit on the relationship between your vocation as a translator and your vocation as a poet, and how the two have related, and how this work of translating John of the Cross has impacted on your own poetry. You've already said a little bit about topic, but maybe could you say a bit more about that?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mentioned this briefly as I was talking earlier about the difficulty of conveying or translating sound sense in a poem from one language to another. And I think, you know, this has really clarified things that were already niggling away at my sort of the obsessive linguist side of my brain, this fact of translation being nearly impossible. And actually, you know, often what we're doing when we write a poem is a sort of act of translation, isn't it? You know, I'm trying to translate into public language something that I am hearing privately. So there's already this difficulty of crossing a boundary when you write a poem in English, as an English poet. So this sort of adds another complex layer to that. I've been reading, there's a really interesting book that isn't about translation, but does inform my own thinking about translation, particularly in poetry now. It's called Gods in the Word by Margaret Magnus. It's a very short, very strange book. She's a linguist, and she's interested in what we might broadly call onomatopoeia, which is a particular obsession of mine at the moment. But particularly, she holds that every consonant sound in the language, in every language, but she takes English as the first example, carries a freight of fixed meaning. And what she means, so she uses several examples that I won't be able to remember them all, but she takes it consonant by consonant and asks you to consider what unites them. So the consonant B, you know, that sound that we make. When we start thinking about all the words that begin with B, we start to notice something that they have in common. You know, bud, birth, bubble, burst, ball, big, any number of others. You can find this grouping. Now, this isn't the only meaning that B has. This is one collection of its meanings. But this is the importance of onomatopoeia, really. You can see why those words are all about swelling, inflating, and then the sudden release of something. And it's because we make that gesture when we make a B sound. We inflate our cheeks and then we expel it explosively. So her thesis is that all of these sounds are carrying inherent embedded onomatopoeic meaning. And it sometimes holds across languages as well. You know, things that begin with st or str are often long and drawn out or somehow elasticy. It's really fascinating. And that has really informed my thinking about sound in poetry more generally. So I've always been interested in form, so I've written sonnets before, you know. But now what I'm really interested in is creating these hidden pathways down through the middle of a poem using secret sounds, you know. And a lot of this is just play. It's just for my own enjoyment, my own pleasure in the language. But I like the idea that it complexifies something that most readers won't even hear, you know. So that's a lot of the work I've been doing at the moment, is experimenting more with sound to create meaning, secondary to narrative.
I was just wondering about kind of the value of engaging with someone's work so deeply. Because I think when you're a reader, there's always this dilemma between, do you try and read widely or do you try and read really deeply? Mm. And what's the importance of reading really, really deeply with someone like that? And what do you gain from that?
Mm. I think for me, it's been all gain, really. As I say, I'd encountered his work before, but I wouldn't have gone that deeply. You know, I'm not an independent scholar. I don't necessarily I wish I had a million lives so that I could go down all of those rabbit holes and read all of these great thinkers and poets, but I don't think I would have had that profound engagement with his work and with his thinking if I hadn't been commissioned to do this project, of course. And what I notice now is that almost everything I read, I hear echoes of John of the Cross. I hear echoes of the Dark Knight, or I hear echoes of the soaring pursuit for the lost love or for God. It feels like it's just expanded my thinking. You know, I'm carrying him around sort of in my ear, and I can hear him urging me to pay attention to this thing or that thing, or to listen more deeply to my own sort of single direction. It's been very useful in that sense. I don't know. It's easy to... I've read interpretations of him that are closer to something like self-help, and I don't really mean to denigrate that at all. You know, there's a lot that is applicable to a great deal of human experience in his writing. But I think that sort of slightly shallower end, the slightly shallower applications of his work, to me, don't quite capture the point, which is this sort of single-minded, passionate focus. So that's what I've drawn from this particular experience. And, you know, it's made me want to do it again, to have that immersive experience with one author at a time. I'll see how many I can fit in my short life.
Is it known why he was imprisoned? And does that influence, you know, did he think it was part of God's plan, or did he have a go at his adversaries? Can you tell us a bit about that, please?
Yes, so it was for his part in the reform of the Carmelites. So he was an adherent of the primitive rule, going back to a life of real deprivation and asceticism. And the first... Oh, what is the word in English? I'm sorry. It's not an order. I've lost the word in English, sorry. The first small organization that he set up in Doruelo was, you know, completely life stripped down to its barest essentials, bare floorboards, holes in the roof, cracking the ice on the drinking water every morning, and just prayer and sweeping. So this was his sense of how Carmelite devotion should be expressed. And really, his imprisonment was the result of great infighting between different factions of the Carmelites. You know, there were rules about how new orders could be founded and how these teachings could be lived, embodied, and he ran up against the authorities in that sense. So they just went and snatched him in the dead of winter and imprisoned him in Toledo. And there was, you know, it sounds like he was more or less deprived completely of, as I say, light and human company, but it does sound as if there were one or two of his jailers who disagreed with his treatment. I mean, he was being lashed weekly in public. You know, it was cruel and unusual, particularly when you read him very deeply, as I have done, you learn that he's just a very gentle person. You begin to imagine what this experience might have been like for him and also for his captors. You know, there's some suggestion that they were, as I say, bringing him writing materials or bringing him letters from his friends and supporters, many of whom decamped to Toledo to be near where he was. You know, he was already a very important figure in the movement in that sense. So that's the story of his imprisonment. What's more mysterious to me really is his escape, because it's this incredible scene, you know, in which he manages to climb out of the window and down to the ground and run away in the dead of night, and is sheltered by people waiting to receive him. But then his captors seem to have just gone, oh, he's gone, you know, and that was it. You know, they didn't try and recapture him. And although he did, throughout his life, he came into conflict with various authorities of the church, you know, for his teachings, for his immoderate poetry sometimes. You know, there were warnings on some of the earliest circulations of these texts that nuns should not be allowed to read them by themselves, which I think is probably fair. And so, you know, he was always a slightly divisive figure in that sense. But it seems that that he was more or less sort of let to practice after that. And in fact, the tensions within the Carmelites changed and mutated, and it wasn't quite so clear cut. It wasn't one faction and another faction as years progressed. So, yeah.
It's been a fascinating session. And I'd just like to say a huge thank you to Martha. Please, Greenbelt, show your appreciation.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.